I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge. Do you remember the first time you fell in love with a piece of music?
I think back to my first introduction to jazz, and it was really a life-changing moment for me. I was in high school. I went into a jazz club, The Lighthouse. It's down on the beach near Los Angeles. And literally within the first 20 seconds of hearing the music, I said to myself, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. And ever since then, my life has been changed by that introduction to jazz.
This is jazz critic Ted Gioia. And what he says reminds me that we all have these seminal jazz moments, like the first time you heard A Love Supreme, or finding out how cool Miles Davis was, or taking a maiden voyage with Herbie Hancock. And for me, I don't remember a time when jazz wasn't part of my life. My dad was a professional jazz musician in New York City, and from the time I was born, jazz just permeated my childhood. I can remember lying in bed and hearing this recording, or something kind of like it, playing somewhere in another room, and it would feel like waves of sound were rocking me to sleep, like floating in an ocean. But somewhere along the way, people started talking about jazz as an artifact.
There's an attitude prevalent in jazz nowadays, and it's one I've got to say I think is so bad for fans and for the music, and it's this idea that jazz is a kind of nutritional supplement, or it's a kind of vitamin. You listen to it because it's good for you. And to my mind, that completely negates the reason I came to jazz, and the other fans I know, the reason they came to jazz is because of just that visceral excitement of hearing it.
Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, jazz is dead? Long live jazz. Ted Gioia, hit it.
To me, the most exciting thing happening in jazz right now is this new dialogue between jazz and popular music in ways that no one ever expected. You know, David Bowie, right before he died, did a jazz album with the very best jazz musicians in the world, and it became a huge seller. And then Prince, right before Prince died, was doing these concerts with just piano accompaniment, and he was working on a jazz album. And then you see Lady Gaga hiring Tony Bennett. Or you see Kendrick Lamar, the rapper, using Kamasi Washington and these great jazz musicians. I see this over and over again. The most visionary people right now in popular music are turning to jazz. I think we are at the early stages of this. And I do believe that over the next 5, 10, 15 years, you're going to see a blossoming of jazz.
So what's the appeal of jazz for big pop stars? You know, like you mentioned Kendrick Lamar, David Bowie, Prince, Lady Gaga. What is it that draws them to jazz?
The music world is in crisis right now. The people running the labels don't like to talk about it, but if you look at the revenues in the music industry, they've been declining since the last century. And what they need right now, I believe, is exactly what jazz has to offer. A visionary approach to music, a creative rule-breaking, a way of getting out of formulas. The music industry is in a rut. If you listen to the radio stations, you hear the same 15 songs over and over again. I really think the music industry right now is similar to the way it was in the early 1950s. In 1952, 1953, nobody could have predicted Elvis and rock and roll, but everybody could hear that sameness, that boring repetition in the music. And they knew that something new was going to come. I think we're in the same situation right now. And I don't believe jazz on its own is the answer, but I believe jazz is part of the solution.
You've said that the first and most important ingredient in jazz is its ecstatic rhythmic quality. What does that mean, ecstatic rhythmic quality?
You know, I wrote my book on how to listen to jazz, and with great trepidation did I approach the opening pages because I knew how difficult it was to define and describe the ingredient that I think is most essential to jazz. And that's that magical rhythmic cohesion between the different performers. That way the bass player and the drummer and the piano player and the horn player, the way they blend together, and there's sort of a give and take. There's nobody that's really the leader, but everybody is able both to express their individuality, their personality, and still blend in with the other performers. Some people call that swing, and I think that's part of it. But when I hear that beautiful blending together of all the musicians in this wonderful rhythmic process we know as jazz, I find it exhilarating. It is ecstatic. And for me, that's the very first thing I listen to in any jazz performance.
For example, pick an album, something new or something old. Think of a track, and then tell us how to listen to it and what to hear.
A handful of recordings have changed how I listen to music. And one that comes almost at the top of the list is a live recording Bill Evans did in 1961 at the Village Vanguard with his trio, with Scott LaFaro on bass and Paul Motion on drums. And there's a certain tragedy around this recording because a few weeks later, Scott LaFaro died in a car crash. So this is really the last recording of this great band. And they did a version of My Foolish Heart, which really is a touchstone for me of musical greatness. First of all, it's the dialogue between the different musicians. And you don't hear the bass and drums accompanying the piano, but really entering into a give and take, a free-flowing dialogue that I had never heard before when I first experienced this recording. The other aspect of it I call attention to is how amazingly slow it is. If you had any more time between the beats in this music, you might think there was no rhythmic pulse. And so it's at the time, it was perhaps the slowest jazz ballad anyone had ever recorded. And so I like to introduce jazz fans to this because, first of all, it shows great jazz doesn't have to always be fast and swinging. It can still have this wonderful rhythmic propulsion, even at a very slow tempo, particularly this one, maybe the slowest of them all.
What is it that sets a great band or a great musician apart, a jazz musician? I mean, what is it they can do that, you know, the second-tier players can't?
At the very top level of jazz, all the techniques, all the book learning, all those rules of harmony are thrown by the wayside. There's a certain level you reach in which you no longer have to think through the names of the chords. You never have to think through the substitute scales. You never have to think back to what you were working on in the practice room because they're such second nature to you. And that next tier is less a technical challenge. It's an emotional, psychological challenge and a battle for authenticity of putting your own personal stamp in the music. And when I hear the very great players, that's the level they're playing at.
Is it partly that they can hear the whole song, the whole piece all at once, as well as, you know, all the tiny little individual decisions and notes?
Some people tell me that great jazz musicians can think ahead, that they're thinking 5, 10, 20, 30 seconds ahead while they're playing. I don't believe that for one moment. I believe that greatness in jazz is to immerse yourself completely in the immediacy of that present moment. And when you get into that state, the music seems to play itself. It's almost as if someone else is playing the music for you when you're performing at that level. And I, you know, this is controversial, but I think this is the reason why so many jazz musicians have had drug problems. I believe that their whole professional existence is about these intense, ecstatic moments in which they are fully invested in that moment. And what do you do when the music is over? What do you do when you leave the club? You go home. It's great for the music, but also I do think there's this jazz personality. I think it does have destructive elements.
Well, you're a musician. Is there a piece of that that's true of you too?
Well, I think all of us that play jazz get a high from it. I mean, I have felt it on occasion, but you know, even more, I recognize it when I hear other people playing jazz at that super high level. I don't think any other genre of music creates that same kind of tightrope act of you going out there in the performance and not knowing beforehand what's going to happen.
Do you think the audience can get a little contact high, you know, a hit of that ecstasy? Does jazz have a psychological effect on listeners?
I've experienced it in the nightclub, and I've seen other people experience it as well. it almost becomes a kind of ecstatic cult or a ritual experience. And afterwards, you try to describe it to someone who wasn't there, and you can't. Mm. You just can't. But there's a certain energy goes through the audience. No, not every time. This doesn't happen every night at the jazz club. But talk to any jazz fan who's been listening to jazz live for more than 5 or 10 years, and they will all have these experiences in which something happened on a specific evening, and they'll just say, oh, I wish it was recorded. I wish I could go back there, because it's this living in the moment that the jazz experience at its highest level can convey. That's the number one reason why I tell people to listen to jazz. You will hear something tonight that will never happen again. And that's rare in any culture, in particular in our musical culture today, where so much is built on repetition and formula.
We started by talking about new directions, new vitality in jazz. Who's out there who's really exciting you right now?
Few musicians have me more excited than Kamasi Washington, a young sax player from Los Angeles. Washington's probably best known for performing with rapper Kendrick Lamar, and this given him visibility among people that normally don't pay attention to jazz. But those folks really need to seek out his album, The Epic, which is an extraordinary work. It's 3 albums, and what Kamasi does on this is he brings a jazz band and a string orchestra and voices and blends it all together in one of the most ambitious projects I've heard in years. Just hear how he is able to have such a big vision of his music. And you just get a sense that even today, in the new millennium, you can have people that have big visions of jazz. It's not just something they learned out of a textbook in school or codified in some sort of teaching method, but really aim for the fences. You know, it's like one of those baseball players trying to hit a home run. And that's what I hear when I hear Kamasi Washington play nowadays.
Ted Gioia is a jazz critic and historian. His new book is called How to Listen to Jazz. And this is Kamasi Washington's 7 Prayers. Coming up, we'll talk with 2 of the most innovative jazz artists working today, Esperanza Spalding and Vijay Iyer. I'm Ann Strainchamps. As to the best of our knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Hey, if you're enjoying this show, check out our new website at ttbook.org. You'll find extended interviews, written stories, and interactive features. For example, One of my favorites is a deep dive with Margaret Wertheim, the physics writer, and it includes pictures of what it looks like to crochet the unknowable geometry of space-time. There's even a photo of my own pathetic attempt at crocheting. It looks like a giant cosmic ruffle. The whole site is a labor of love. Stop by at ttbook.org. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hey, this is Alex Abramovich. I'm the author of Bullies of Friendship, and I'd like to talk about a book that means a lot to me. It's called Blues People. It's by Leroy Jones. Whenever you're in the middle of writing a book, there are books that you're a little bit afraid of. You're afraid of reading them because you're afraid that they're too close to the subject and too close to the heart of what you have to say about it. So they're the books that actually you avoid at all costs. Right now, the book I'm writing is a history of American music, and the book that's closest to the heart of that project, and it's one of my favorite books in the world, is this book from 1963 by Leroy Jones, who was a great poet and playwright in New York at the time. The book is subtitled Negro Music in White America, and what it really is, it's a history of the American people, not just the African American people, but really I would say the American people, told through American music, which turns out to be the absolutely perfect aperture to force that history through, because it's a history of the country as it was made by people who weren't necessarily literate, weren't in charge of the narrative that emerged, who were far from the centers of power, but who nevertheless interacted and helped shape and form not just the physical country, but also the spiritual and emotional and aesthetic core of the country. And Jones, who was very young when he wrote this book, he was later changed his name to Amiri Baraka. Jones really brilliantly captured the story of that narrative going all the way back to Africa. And I didn't understand until I read this book how deep the roots of this music were and how much of America and how much of the American people the music could reflect. It's also because he's a poet and just an amazing sentence writer. It's one of the most beautiful books you'll ever read. It's a nonfiction book that reads like a novel.
Alex Abramovich recommends Blues People by Leroy Jones. You'll find more bookmarks and an interview with Abramovich on our website at ttbook.org. You're listening to Esperanza Spalding. She's one of those young artists reinventing jazz. A few years ago, when she was just 26, she became the first jazz musician to win a Grammy Award for Best New Artist. She beat out Justin Bieber, Drake, and Mumford & Sons, so kind of shocked the music industry. By now, she's won multiple Grammys and admirers in and out of the jazz world, from Prince to Barack Obama. So when Esperanza Spalding was in town recently, Steve Paulson asked her to stop by.
Well, it is such a pleasure to have you
here.
Hey,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks. So I want to start out by talking about your new album, Emily's D+ Evolution. Is
Correct.
That how you say it?
That's perfect.
Okay. And I know Emily is your middle name.
Yes.
So artistically, does that name have particular meaning for you?
Well, artistically, maybe functionally, it has meaning because it's my middle name. And Emily is a character that erupted out of my middle, I suppose.
So what was that was in the middle then?
Wow, I'm discovering it. Movement, loudness, theatrical performance. Emily, this idea that came to me was really unique and it was really powerful. Like it really kind of came over me like a wave. And I said, whoa, okay, I guess I'm going to have to express this and manifest it. I probably won't be able to rest with myself until I do, you know.
Was there a moment when Emily sort of like, I don't know, came into your consciousness?
Yeah, absolutely. It was after a concert in Austin, Texas. It was the night before my birthday and I got back to the hotel. And I think this happens often. Well, it happens to everybody, but it also happens to creative people that you're just charged, you know. You didn't have coffee. You don't really know why, but and it's getting later and later, and you're just kind of buzzing with this energy. And often inspiration strikes in those moments, and that night it did for me. And in my mind's eye, I started seeing these little vignettes, and I saw this character like coming into a diner, and I was observing the way she was interacting with people she met, and it was kind of like a musical playing out. And I started to hear these song names and kind of see this performance style happening like on a late night show or something that was really active and colorful, and the music was colorful and active. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. Let me make as many notes as I can about what I'm seeing.
Wow, it was sort of like your unconscious was speaking to
you. I think so, yeah.
See this pretty girl. Watch this pretty girl flow.
So I have to ask you about one of the tracks on
sure.
your album, Good Lava,
mm-hmm.
which is, it's about creativity. I mean, the lava, the eruption
yeah.
of creativity.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Good Lava originally started as a playful idea about what if when you're playing with your friends, jumping from furniture piece to furniture piece, when you say, oh, you can't touch the ground because it's lava, what if you were like, no, let's jump into it because it's good lava. Why are we afraid of this? It's our imagination. It can't burn us. It's wonderful. Let's dive into the good, gooey, sticky, scary stuff. That's where the juiciest possibilities happen, you know.
So it sounds like you think a lot about where creativity comes from. I mean, sort of how to tap into these different parts of yourself, maybe? I don't know. Or channeling other influences into your own art?
Wow, I don't think about it very much. I do think about the function of creativity within artistic expression and in day-to-day life. And I feel in my life that whenever I run into conflict or fear or like a sticky situation with colleagues or with family or my own, you know, work, I discover that, ooh, I don't know how to do that, or I'm angry at this person, or what? How are we going to get out of this? It's really the act of creative thinking and creative engagement that moves you from a place of stasis to a place of possibility. The key element, the universal element that we, A, all have in common, and B, all have in our fingertips is creativity. And it's wonderful. It's like, it's the best news ever. You've got it. It's already yours. And I really think now that's what Emily came to teach me about. Well, what about creativity and why?
I want the world. I want the whole world. Give it to me now.
I'm curious about your background, because I've read that you started playing music really young, right?
Yeah, I did. I started playing violin after I saw Yo-Yo Ma on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Really? Just watching TV and you saw Yo-Yo
yeah.
Ma playing?
Well, there were a few steps between when I saw him when I got the violin, but yeah.
Like how old were you?
I think I was 5.
Wow.
Really, I wasn't looking to get into music. I heard Yo-Yo Ma play that thing. He played one of the Bach cello suites, now I know. And I couldn't believe it. I had never seen anything like that before, and I wanted to do it. I wanted to make those kinds of sounds. I didn't know what a cello was called, so I asked for violin, and that was not the instrument I was expecting to get. But
and you played for a long time, right?
I did, yeah. The music never seemed like a career or like a life choice or something that I had to do. My parental figures never guilted me into practicing or forced me to practice. I liked to make sounds. I still like to just make sounds.
So I read somewhere that your mother actually pulled you out of school, right?
Yeah, that was for other unrelated reasons. I just had a lot of health issues that started around the fifth grade, and I ended up missing so much school that I couldn't catch up. It became really stressful. So she pulled me out and started homeschooling. Because I grew up with a single working mom, our version of homeschooling was me home alone all day with the textbooks that we'd checked out from the library for the, you know, the various subjects for that year. And so I was free and very unsupervised. And I spent a lot of that time making sounds, actually, and playing piano and playing clarinet and all manner of instruments I could get my hands on.
So kind of, you're just kind of teaching yourself then?
Kind of. Yeah.
But you were playing classical music during those. I mean, basically when you were a teenager, right?
Yeah. All through 5 through 15, I was a bona fide little classical musician. But I should say, to be honest, I really had no respect for authority. And I never did what I was supposed to. I never practiced what I was supposed to practice, ever. I feel so sorry for those teachers now, because I've had some of those students, and it's heartbreaking, and it's maddening when you're giving your time and the kid just doesn't care. And I was that kid, unfortunately.
Well, it seemed to turn out pretty
well. Yeah, in some ways. Now, I think the underlying energy of that was like, I need to be myself.
So when did you start playing jazz?
Around 15. Yeah, when I discovered the bass.
The stand-up bass, yeah.
I really loved the music I was playing as a classical musician. I loved the music. That's the only thing that kept me in there. I didn't like the people. I thought everybody was really tyrannical, and now I have that vocabulary. I didn't have the vocabulary then. And I thought they didn't like me, and I thought they thought I sucked, and I felt like I was sort of like a token colored person making the program look good. I felt very uncomfortable the whole time. But music, oh my God. You know, we'd play Scheherazade, and I think I actually worked my way up to concertmaster because I was jealous that this other boy had the solo spot on that piece. But once the music came in and you're in the center of this sea of sound and harmony, I mean, everything else melted away, you know. That's what kept me in the music. So at 15, then discovering improvised music.
It's sort of like what you were waiting for all that time.
I was waiting for my whole life. And I liked the people better, you know. At least in Portland, people I started to meet that were in the jazz community were really cool, you know. And I felt really seen, and I felt really encouraged to explore, which is what I've been missing in the classical pedagogy.
And did you start playing in clubs then, pretty soon after that?
Yeah, I did. You can always work if you're a good bass player. And I'm sure there was a certain novelty factor of, like, this little kid showing up, this girl that...
There probably aren't that many girl bassists.
There weren't then. Yeah, there weren't very many girl anythings outside of the classical music scene. Anyway, all of this is just backstory. But improvisation... That was like the message. That was the answer and the message and everything. And you know, even though right now I'm not as engaged in the jazz scene.
But you're still sort of, you're known.
Yeah.
As a jazz performer.
Yeah, that doesn't go away. What I was going to say is that even though I'm not actively engaged to the same degree in the jazz community, the life, to me, what it means to be an improvising musician is like the bedrock of my life. That's how I see the world. My life is an improvisation. It's a prepared improvisation. And being a jazz musician, quote unquote, I'm obviously related to that core lineage of what the aesthetic heritage and the cultural heritage of the music is. But just because what I do doesn't look or sound like the origins of that lineage, it's still in the family, obviously.
Do you worry? I mean, there's so much talk. I mean, there has been for years now about concern, worry about jazz. You know, is there an audience? Does that bother you?
I mean, it's people's music, you know. In a way, it's like it evolves on its own to a certain degree. Like none of us can hold it in one container and say, this is it and the rest is not. It lives in the people who practice it. That's it. So I can't even say anything about what it is. All I can say is what it is to me. Still, when I wake up in the morning, if I want to get going, if I need something to like soothe my soul or lift my spirits, I want to hear Oscar Peterson. That's not because I know I should listen to Oscar Peterson. I want to, like, I want to eat donuts or like I want to eat a salad if I want that. It resonates with who I am for whatever reason. And it did the first time I heard it. It just hit me. And I said, this is my thing. I didn't know you were here. I didn't know you were here, Solos. I didn't know you were here, Coltrane. I didn't know you were here, Paul Chambers. Like, wow, thank you. And guess what? There are other idioms and there are other permutations from similar environmental circumstances that will arise that have the heart and the spirit of improvisation and of studied application okay, that will rise and reach and soothe and be the balm and the medicine for the people who need it, just like jazz music was and mm-hmm. is.
Are you thinking about rap here?
Yeah, I'm thinking about rap.
So you're sort of like drawing this direct connection between rap and jazz.
I'm just thinking about folk music, you mm-hmm. know? And of course, like, folk music doesn't mean simple. To me, like, jazz music and rap music is like a place where you feel the competitive urgency of being great, but your vocabulary is your experience. You use that. You use that vocabulary to become the best you can at telling your story with other people. It's a beautiful experience, I want to say, to feel like, oh, damn, they're doing, woof, they said it. I can't say it like that. You go home and you get your vocabulary together and you figure out how you can show up the next Saturday or whatever and be present and be heard and contribute in the language. And that phenomenon is not unique to jazz.
Streets lined with red brick and green branches. Wooden rainy days that might seem bleak. Our rain is the paint that makes the land lush and the folks unique. City parks, wild berries, and the bridges. Rolling river bringing good.
That's singer and bassist Esperanza Spalding. She talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, Norwegian phenom Tord Gustafsson picks a favorite jazz album and a conversation with Vijay Iyer about improvisation and the parallels between jazz and basketball. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Is to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. And now it's time to get into some deep tracks.
Hi, I'm Tord Gustafsson, Norwegian pianist who just released the album What Was Said on ECM Records, together with vocalist Simin Tander and drummer Jarle Vespestad, where we do Sufi explorations of my Christian roots, to put it in a slogan. But now I'm here to talk about one of the albums that has been a major influence on me and on my music over the years. I've chosen a classic in European jazz history, an album called Band Apart. It was released on ECM Records in the 80s by the Norwegian band Mascualero. This is such a gorgeous album. It's explorative, very free, open-minded, at the same time hauntingly beautiful melodies, and it also has all these lines spreading from it backwards and forwards in history. It has Tore Brunborg on saxophone, who is now part of my instrumental quartet and with whom I've toured over the last 4 years a lot. His playing is there. He was very young there, but it was all already so mature and so creative, and taking, like, making sense of this melting pot between Norwegian folk traditions and improvisation. And then on trumpet, there is Nils Petter Molvær, who became one of the major stars of the European scene and one of the most important pioneers in bridging electronica and jazz and house music and jazz in the 90s. And his playing has never been stronger than already there in the 80s, when he and Ture then shared the front in this band. And then there is Jon Christensen on drums, who also played in the legendary quartet with Keith Jarrett and Jan Garbarek. So he's really the link there to Keith Jarrett and to the whole incredibly inspiring catalog of Jarrett. All these details aside, there is the songwriting, the willingness to take the leap of faith, to really go for it, to cherish beauty and to at the same time have this follow the urge to be here and now, to have the rawness of emotional intensity here and now. For instance, then in the track called Nyl, N-Y-L, which is one of my favorites on the album. This is a gorgeous album.
Jazz pianist Tord Gustafsson, he recommends Mascalero's album Bond Apart. One of the most celebrated musicians in jazz today is Vijay Iyer. He's been Downbeat Magazine's Artist of the Year and also Pianist of the Year. He's a MacArthur genius with a PhD in music cognition. So the questions that fascinate him are things like, what is music and what does it do for us? When Vijay Iyer was in town recently, Steve Paulson caught up with him backstage. They talked about jazz, improvisation, and the origins of music.
Ready to do this?
Someone wrote all over her.
Vijay, from what I can see, you straddle various different worlds. You're a professor at Harvard, high-profile jazz musician. You have a background in science, a PhD in the science of music cognition. Obviously, a jazz musician, but you go way beyond jazz. I mean, you go into other kinds of music, classical music, both Indian and Western, hip-hop, electronic music. Is it part of your project to break down these categories?
I don't know if it's part of my project or just part of my reality, but I don't really see those categories as particularly meaningful, because when you really get down to artistic collaboration or just the artistic process, creative process, you can't put a label on it, you know?
You can't put a label on jazz?
Well, people keep using that label even when every single musician in the history of the music rejects it. So whose fault is that? It's not theirs.
Do you reject it too?
Well, I am part of a history of people who at least apply pressure to that word. And that was true for Duke Ellington. It's true for Charlie Parker. It's true for Miles Davis. It's true for John Coltrane. It's true for Charles Mingus. And basically, it's the history of the music. It's a history of resistance and defiance to gestures of categorization and limiting.
Are you more interested then in the question of what is music?
I'm interested in some fundamental questions. What is music? Mm-hmm. Why do we all have it? What does it do for us?
Why have we always had it?
Yes. So that sounds like a science question, but it's actually one that most artists find themselves asking.
Do you think about that? I mean, I'm thinking particularly because you have the science background. I mean, do you wonder what our ancestors did tens of thousands of years ago? I mean, basically the first music, what that might have been?
Yeah, I mean, I think about that all the time. You know, as a performing artist, which means somebody who performs in gatherings of conspecifics, you'd say, people who are fellow human beings, I want to know how it's going to work. And what is it that we're doing? And I've experienced some very primal kinds of sensations and feelings, like hearing an entire room full of people breathing together, mm-hmm. exhaling at the same time. The fact that we can even do that without even thinking or deliberately doing it, but that music can bring us to that point, means that there's something much more going on here than genre and style and stuff like that.
Or, well, in the way, what you're saying then, I mean, to suggest maybe the origins is it's a communal act. It's not just one person sitting down and doing it by himself or herself.
Yeah, it never was. We've never been alone. We've always been among each other. That's what it means to be part of a species. It's been very rare for us to ever be alone. And what that means is that we're actually really good at hearing each other, to hear the human voice, but also to decode things like footsteps. Because until 100 years ago, there weren't recordings. And so what music always meant was the presence of another person or another group of people.
You play and someone else is listening, or you're all playing together and listening together.
Right. It meant sociality.
Now you have, from what I've heard, you have a pretty unusual background. You never actually studied jazz formally, did you?
Well, I would claim that the entire history of this music is populated by people who never studied jazz formally, because it wasn't a thing to study formally. It was about self-motivated, collaborative co-creation.
So how did you learn to,
do that?
How did you learn to play? Just by joining groups?
I learned to play
groups.
The way that the elders learned to play, which was by listening and apprenticing. That's what I did.
So now you are a professor of music at Harvard. There seems to be an irony here.
I don't know. The irony is really just about a certain definition of music, which is not broad enough to encompass the range of phenomena that we're talking about.
I've read that one of the classes you teach at Harvard, I think a graduate seminar, is theorizing improvisation. Is that right?
Yes.
Which, again, sounds almost like an oxymoron there, but maybe not. Can you tell me a little bit about the conceptual idea behind the class?
Well, for one thing, we think of improvisation as something that happens sometimes in music under extreme circumstances. But what we let ourselves forget is that we're all improvising all the time and that life is actually made of improvisation.
But there's something more specific about music, especially if you are playing a piece of music that someone else has written. I mean, there are going to be decisions, I presume, and I don't know if it's an intellectual process.
Well,
or
we get trained. I won't say we get trained. We learn through doing what the range of options are. I meet people all the time, especially like classical musicians, who say, I can't improvise. And then I ask them to do something like, okay, here's five choices of possible things to do, and you decide when to do them. They say, I can't do that. And then they do it. I say, guess what? Guess what you're doing right now? The thing is that we all do this. So we've been trained to believe that improvisation is rare and scarce and strange, rather than so omnipresent it's actually kind of banal. But when you bring that sensibility of, like, how do we do everyday life, then to your instrument, you just bring that same sensibility, like, well, what should I play next? Or what note should I play now? You know, I wonder what happens if I put these two things together. You know, we could talk about a game of basketball, all right, which is a highly regulated situation where every step you make and every move you make and how long you can hold the ball and whom you pass it to and when, and you're under surveillance, right? And there's only a handful of options you have at any moment, and yet the outcome of every game is unforeseen.
And the players we tend to celebrate the most are those who exercise the most creativity.
In the moment.
In the moment, yeah.
Those extreme conditions of...
And there are obvious benefits. I mean, you know, you're harder to guard, you know, if you can do the unpredictable.
For example, yeah.
I mean, we've just witnessed Steph Curry.
Yes, indeed we have. That was the reason I brought it up.
Right.
So, you know, that's an example where you could say it's just a tremendous staged improvisation that has a lot of rules that govern the moment to moment, but also from moment to moment, we don't actually know what's about to happen. So music is not so different.
You are sitting at a piano right now. We were just talking about Steph Curry. He just had this amazing game last night. Does anything come to mind musically? Just if you...
Oh, no.
Basketball? I'm guessing you're a basketball fan.
There was a tune I wrote. You know, actually, some years ago, I was invited. I don't know why, but I wrote a bunch of tunes for ESPN.
Really? ESPN? How did that...
That's right. I was
Harvard
professor?
Did they use them?
I am not aware of them having used them, but they liked them. And I think it was, I'm not sure what happened, but they commissioned a little, like, basically an album's worth of 2-minute cues.
Wow. Do you remember any of those?
Yeah.
Could you play one?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was for a band. I mean, basically, uh-huh. they wanted something like small, fast, and loose, something that sounded like improvisation. So I made one called The Prowl. I don't know if I can play it, really. but it was just about the way people move on the court. Huh. I can't play it,
you
but I'll try. But I can't.
Thank you.
That was just, that wasn't even really it. At some point I realized, oh, I don't actually know how this goes. So I just.
I guess it illustrates what we were just talking about. But I love, and you said that was, you called that The Prowl.
Yes, I did.
Which, I mean, I had the sense of, you know, there was stalking going on at the beginning, and then there was almost the pounce, and then this cacophony of stuff happened.
Well, just sort of like rough and tumble kind of atmosphere. Uh-huh. So it's sort of about finding a balance or a way to move with grace and fluidity in the midst of what seems like a stressful situation.
Now, there are a lot of musicians who, we identify a particular sound with, you know, Thelonious Monk has a particular sound. Jimmy Smith has a particular sound. Sometimes it changes. Maybe late Coltrane sound is different than early Coltrane. Is there a distinctive Vijay Iyer sound?
That's not for me to say. I mean,
you must have a sense of that, though.
Well, there are certain things I don't like.
Like what?
And then when I hear myself doing them, I'm like, oh, no. But I also, I'm interested in the core of something, and then the way it manifests in what I do, I kind of don't have a lot of direct access to or control over. Maybe overall, something emerges that's like, well, this is what he sounds like.
You know. But it sounds like you're saying that you want the experience of playing to take you someplace.
Yeah.
To take you someplace that is, it takes a little work to get there.
Well, yes. That's what I'm doing. I'm working.
Where do you want to go? I mean, what's that place that you're searching for?
You could say it's some kind of quality of release, or more to the point, it's some kind of moment of connection with listeners, which usually comes from being vulnerable and opening yourself to that. But that feeling of, like I said, everyone breathing together, everyone kind of receiving an experience together. That's basically what I'm after. And it's not even that I want to give it to them. I want us all to have it together.
Would you call that a moment of transcendence?
Well, it is sort of about reminding ourselves of who and what we are as a species. So sometimes in those moments, we seem to think we're leaving our brains or leaving our bodies. But what's really happening is that something much more ancient inside of us that's been with us for 1,000 centuries is being tapped into.
Wow. Can you articulate what you think that is, what we're tapping into?
Well, it's exactly what can't be articulated. That's partly why we have music, which is exactly also what can't be articulated. It's what, it's like the artist Thornton Dial. He once said, if we understood each other, we wouldn't have art. We wouldn't need to make art. So this is a way of accessing something before understanding that lies before or beyond or beneath understanding.
Vijay Iyer talking with Steve Paulson backstage before a recent concert in Madison. This is from his new album with Wadada Leo Smith called A Cosmic Rhythm with Each Stroke. That's it for our show today, but there's always more in our podcast feed. You'll find us on iTunes or Stitcher or on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson. He had help from Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Mark Rickers. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. See you next week. Thank you.